First case for argument this afternoon is the U.S. versus Hixon. And if I can follow all these numbers correctly, I think Mr. C, is it Zekeli?
It's
Zekeli.
Right?
Zekeli? Yes, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Zekeli, and I, along with Michael Lawler, represent Isaac Smith in this case. Mr. Smith has raised a total of three issues in this appeal, all of which are joined by Ms. Gunn, two of which are joined by Mr. Hixon. Due to the time limits of the argument here today, I'd like to address my argument as to two of those issues. First, the issue of whether the district court committed error in denying repeated motions by Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn to declare a mistrial and or sever Ms. Gunn and Mr. Smith from Mr. Hixon. And secondly, the second issue I'd be arguing today is whether the district court committed an error in issuing a willful blindness instruction. I'd like to preface this, and I think the context of this entire argument, the entire case, I think this equally applies to the arguments Mr. Robinson will be making, is the complexity of this case. This was a six-week trial involving a million pages of discovery, hundreds of government exhibits, and dozens of government witnesses.
It won't surprise you to know we have complicated cases here, will it?
Absolutely, Your Honor, absolutely.
It will surprise you to know that.
It does not surprise me to know that. But I think it was surprising perhaps to Mr. Hixon to find himself representing himself in a case of this magnitude, in a case of this complexity. And it was in large part due to the complexity and length of this case why the district court committed error in not permitting Mr. Hixon to go on trial separately from Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn after he made the decision to represent himself. And I know that Mr. Robinson is going to be addressing whether or not that was an appropriate decision by the district court. But so far as concerns Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn, the decision was made and they then found themselves standing trial with a pro se litigant whose conduct and theory of the case prejudiced them such that they were denied their right to a fair trial. And I'd like to primarily talk about Mr. Hixon's conduct in connection to his handling of exhibits. The District of Maryland has a local rule which essentially requires parties to exchange exhibits prior to them being mentioned in court, and a second local rule which essentially says that once an exhibit is mentioned on the record, it's deemed admitted. So objections, by and large, are expected to be made prior to an exhibit being shown to the jury or referenced during a trial. Mr. Hixon repeatedly flaunted that rule. And whether it was intentionally or simply because he didn't know, nonetheless, he was permitted to repeatedly violate that rule. At some points, putting up exhibits which were to the detriment of Mr. Smith, which the government never even sought to admit. Additionally, Your Honors, at the time that he chose to present his direct testimony in his own defense, he came to court that morning with a very large stack of exhibits that both the government and Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn objected to him being able to introduce those due to the fact that he came in and said, I'm going to be testifying, and here's the mountain of exhibits, essentially, I'm going to be referring to.
So are you telling me late exhibits are never allowed in court?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Late exhibits are certainly permissible, and I think the record probably shows that there are times that Mr. Smith introduced late exhibits as well. But the lateness of the exhibits prejudiced the parties because essentially the district court said, well, if there's any exhibits Mr. Hixon's going to use that he used, that the government's already admitted, he may refer to those.
So your biggest claim of error is that exhibits were introduced late in violation of the local rule?
No, sir, it's not. The biggest claim of error is essentially that these exhibits were used to support a theory of the case, which Mr. Hixon pursued, which was directly prejudicial to Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn. And that's the theory of the case. And these exhibits, it was harmful because the exhibits essentially became almost a trial by ambush situation where not only were we defending charges of the government, whose case was laid out and we had ample time to prepare for, but there was also this issue of Mr. Hixon, who's...
I don't understand. Is your claim, your biggest claim to error, trial by ambush or... inconsistent defenses.
The claim to error is inconsistent defenses. However, these were not known until midway through the trial.
I was just wondering, are you going to talk about that claim?
Yes, sir. I'm going to talk about it right now. At the beginning of the...
You know, let me say this much, because if it comes down to ambush and exhibits didn't follow the local rule, that's not a very strong argument, I don't think. I mean, that's abuse of discretion, isn't it?
That is. Well, all these issues are abuse of discretion, Your Honor. The severance and mistrial are abuse of discretion. But Mr. Hixon's attorney when he was represented, stood up and said, I'm not going to be taking a position adverse to, this is a pretrial motions, to other defendants in this case. The court looks at, Mr. Martin deferred his opening statement in this case. But if the court looks at those cross-examinations, which Mr. Martin did conduct in the course of this trial, those cross-examinations lended themselves to going along with the same theory of the case that Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn were pursuing, which was essentially we were good faith actors in a business, and to the extent there were problems, we reasonably relied on the assurances of other people in this company, namely Andrew Williams, who was tried and convicted separately, that everything was okay. Mr. Hickson's theory of the case, which emerged during the course of his self-representation, essentially was, I was telling everybody that there were problems. Specifically, Hickson 17, I said,
you know, I want to interrupt you again. You can take it that we know the facts of the case. It seems to me that you need to go straight to your legal arguments. Maybe you're there already. But I'm, I think that your argument is the position he took was inconsistent with the other, with your defense. Is that correct?
It was inconsistent. And if the jury believed that Mr. Hickson was correct in saying there are problems in this business and it could be a fraud, the jury could not believe the other defendants saying that we were not on notice that there were problems in this business.
Well, weren't you on notice that that was going to be the government's entire case against you? There were problems in this business and it is a fraud. So how was that a surprise to you? That's the indictment.
As Mr. Hickson testified, that I told Mr. Smith in November of 2006 that this is a problem. And prior to that testimony, there was no evidence going that far back that anyone had told Mr. Smith anything of that sort. And that is why, if you believe Mr. Hickson saying, I told Mr. Smith, and additionally asked to Ms. Gunn, Your Honor, Ms. Gunn was nowhere mentioned in anything to do with this report going back to 2006. That was just words on paper until Mr. Hickson said that Ms. Gunn helped me compile the information that made the report. So he brought Ms. Gunn into the government's theory at a much earlier date than could otherwise have been. And that's why these are inconsistent. If you believe that Mr. Hickson was telling everyone, I'm worried this is a fraud, then you couldn't believe when Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn said, we were good faith actors, no one told us at an appropriate time this was a fraud until the end. And that's the heart of the inconsistency. If you believed Mr. Hickson, you couldn't believe the other two cases. And if you believe the other two cases, you couldn't believe Mr. Hickson. And that is the court's precedent says, if you have these mutually irreconcilable defenses, not just we don't like each other or we're going to be sort of pointing fingers, but if you believe one, you can't believe the other. And that's the heart of the argument. That is where the prejudice arose from. If you believed everything Mr. Hickson said he did at that business, you couldn't believe everything the other witnesses, the other defendants put on as their defense. And that is, so far as that goes, that's the argument to that. And if the court has no further questions, I'll move on to the willful blindness issue briefly.
Okay.
As to willful blindness, there was a dispute in this case as to whether or not there was actual knowledge. The government took the position there was, the defense took the position we weren't. When you look at deliberate ignorance, you can either show deliberate ignorance through actual acts or the jury can make an inference of it. And in this case, the government was unable to show any actual acts, and the jury could certainly and was asked to decide, is there actual knowledge on the part of the defendants in this case? But the jury was not presented with facts from which they could reasonably infer a deliberate ignoring of facts which would suggest.
What about the Lipsman email? Isn't that sufficient for a willful blindness instruction?
Well, as to Ms. Gunn, Your Honor, I'll start with that. As to Ms. Gunn, as we mentioned in our brief, it's not exactly clear whether Ms. Gunn ever received that email or not. It's inconclusive, and I think the record would reflect it was inconclusive as to Ms. Gunn. As to Mr. Smith and Mr. Hickson, it was that there were problems, but every business has problems, and Mr. Smith's and the problems were perhaps of a sort that could lead to legal consequences, but Mr. Smith turned and said, let's fix this. It wasn't a deliberate ignorance. It says, here's a problem, let's fix it. It wasn't, I read it.
Well, that's your view of the evidence. The government had a different view. It doesn't seem to me that those instructions are mutually inconsistent and could have been supported. A jury finding could have been supported based on the evidence as to actual knowledge and or willful blindness.
If I could, I see my time is just about up, if I could briefly respond. That email, again, as to Ms. Gunn and is inclusive whether she ever received it. And as to Mr. Smith and Mr. Hickson, it was identifying there were problems. The email did not say this is a fraud. This is, there are problems, and Mr. Smith's reaction was, well, if there's problems, let's fix
that. And doesn't it also say the program can easily be characterized as a fraudulent scheme?
It did, unless certain steps are taken to remedy the situation, and Mr. Smith's reaction was, well, let's fix it, not you caught us, it's a fraud. He essentially did say, let's find out what the problems are and let's fix them. He certainly did not deliberately ignore this email or deliberately ignore the facts within the email. He said, well, if there's a problem, let's get it sorted out.
Well, does the jury have to believe that? About let's try to sort it out?
Well, if the jury believes...
Do they have to believe that?
No, the jury doesn't. The jury can...
They don't have to. Okay. Thank you very much. You've reserved some time, as I understand my chart. Do you have some time reserved?
4 minutes, yes.
Okay, good. Next, Mr. Robinson.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Robinson on behalf of Michael Hickson. In this brief time that I have, I'd like to address Hickson's underlying claim that his right to counsel has been violated as a result of, yes, partially his decisions, but also what transpired in the district court. We would argue that Hickson's right to counsel, his right to due process and a fair trial was violated when the district court denied his request for short continuance, after he made known to the court of his concerns with his attorney Martin. At that point...
A short recess for what purpose?
Well, his words were to get any other attorney he could. And in his mind, he had lost faith in his attorney.
I understand. Do you think it's an abuse of discretion for the court to believe it had taken more than a short recess for any other lawyer to get up to speed on this case?
I don't think that was relevant to the decision. I think if Mr. Hickson could get an attorney that he wanted, that is what satisfied the constitutional standard.
It certainly is relevant if the court thinks that what he proposes to do is not possible to get a lawyer. Because it's not just getting a lawyer. It has to be a lawyer who's prepared to handle the case.
I understand.
But you're suggesting that the court cannot properly take that into account in its consideration?
Well, I'm not going to ever say that a judge can't take something into consideration, period. But I think that the fact is if the court was willing to allow a continuance, a short continuance, even only a day, if Mr. Hickson was able to get an attorney that was willing to take that case, and I understand logistically it might be very, very, very difficult to do that.
The co-defendants would be up here right now going to court, let this lawyer in this case.
Right.
With this complicated a case, we've heard about how long it took, how many pages of discovery. Clearly it was an abuse of discretion and violated our client's right because you let a lawyer in the case who didn't clear the documents and exchange evidence in advance.
Right.
I mean, a district court takes all that into account, don't you think?
I certainly think.
I can understand you don't have to argue that it does, but
yes.
It seems to me a court does.
I cannot obviously get inside what the judge is going to think, but I understand the problem with trying to get an attorney in that short amount of time. But regardless of that factor, and I guess maybe saying it's not relevant was too strong of a phrase.
You think your strongest argument is a due process violation that he didn't grant the continuance?
No, it all leads together. The strongest argument is a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Period. When you're asking for a new attorney, the Smith case out of the Fourth Circuit that we discussed in the brief spells out the test very. Well, nice three-point test, timeliness of the request, the adequacy of the district court's inquiry into the problems with counsel, and then finally, whether or not the attorney-client conflict was so great that it prevented an adequate defense. This has nothing to do with Strickland. This is not ineffective assistance of counsel. This is whether or not, first with respect to timeliness, although the request came after 4 days of trial, certainly it's an inconvenient point. Obviously, it's very inconvenient. However, it came at the moment from Mr. Hickson's mouth
What's
that this conflict manifested itself.
What's the standard of review here?
Well, there's an abuse of discretion and also a de novo standard for the constitutional claims.
And which claim is a de novo review?
The constitutional claims
as far that he didn't have counsel.
That he did not have counsel. He was constructively denied counsel as a result of these decisions. But, you know, leading up to that, this request, you know, first of all, he did not make the request was untimely in the sense that it came in an inconvenient point. But I read no case that says just because you make this these facts known to the court after the start of trial doesn't per se make this request untimely. Instead, the court is concerned with whether or not it's made for the purposes of delay or whether or not the court had repeatedly provided different counsel for a defendant.
You think that would fall under untimely?
I'm citing straight out of the cases dealing with the timeliness factors, United States versus DeTemple and United States versus Morsley. Both out of the Fourth Circuit and cited in our brief, talk about those are cases that deal with the timeliness of a request. And when you go into the analysis of it, both of these requests, the judge's decisions were upheld not to give a new attorney to these defendants. But the difference was in those cases, there was either a purpose of delay or a ploy on the part of the defendant in making this request.
Do you think that time matters at all?
Yes. Time obviously matters. Time obviously matters.
When would it matter?
And it weighs against this defendant.
You have to let me finish my
question
before you answer.
Sorry, Your Honor.
How does time matter then if you say that in all those cases it wasn't a question of when it's made? Seems to me if time has to, it has to be determined in part by when the request is made.
You are accurate about that, Your Honor. I was simply pointing out that with respect to the timeliness factor, although it weighs against Hickson,
that it may not just be the only thing.
It's not the only thing. The second part is the district court's inquiry. And this, I have a few seconds here, and I want to, this is a very important point.
Okay.
The inquiry occurred was inadequate. It was inadequate because the court used the wrong standard. The court's inquiry was about whether or not he was receiving effective assistance of counsel under Strickland. It wasn't about whether an irreconcilable conflict existed between the parties. And the attorney, Mr. Martin, and Mr. Hickson both confirmed that this irreconcilable conflict existed.
You reserve some time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr. Ake?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Ake.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent the District of Maryland in this case. Before I just have a few things in response to the questions that were posed by the court and comments by opposing counsel, and then I'd be like the court just to address any questions they have for me. First, I want to address the prejudice issue. This court's precedents are very clear and consistent with courts around the country that prejudice in the face of a motion for severance has a different technical meaning than Webster's would seem to suggest. It's not just that bad things happen necessarily or that could happen. Prejudice in this vein only results when you have defenses that are not just adversarial but so mutually inconsistent that...
Well, were they?
Essentially, no, Your Honor. And it was
not
consistent.
Why were they not?
They were not because all three defendants at bottom argued that they were dupes of Andrew Williams. And that was consistent in their opening statements, and that was consistent all the way through the closing statements. Not just, and getting to the idea that somehow the tenor or the thrust of Defendant Hickson's defense changed substantially after he dismissed Attorney Martin or asked not to be represented directly by Attorney Martin.
Well, I think Mr. Sicali said this. If you believe that Mr. Hickson, if the jury believed Mr. Hickson told Smith and Gunn that he had questions, that the jury would have to convict Smith and Gunn. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor.
Why don't you agree with that?
Your Honor, because Mr. Hickson posed the same questions to Mr. Williams, and his explanation for why he still lacked any criminal intent was because Mr. Williams was so persuasive in assuaging.
Is your argument that Smith and Gunn could have relied on Williams as well?
Exactly, Your Honor. And they did. All three of them maintained that Mr. Williams was, and they brought it out and cited all the other witnesses that had testified essentially the same thing, that Mr. Williams was so persuasive and so believable, such an effective con man, that he was able to dupe everyone. And that was the heart of the defense. So there's no fundamental inconsistency here. And the only cases that have found prejudice in the face of these types of severance motions are those where essentially the defendants become akin to like caged animals where they have to, only one's going to emerge, that essentially the burden is off the government.
I don't know about all that. It looks to me the best way to state it might be if the jury believes one
has
story,
to disbelieve it.
It necessarily cannot believe the second story.
Which is unfairly shifts the burden from the government to the defendant to disprove his guilt in the face of a defense from his co-defendant that essentially is going to rely on proving him guilty. And that's not what we had here. Hixon was not attempting to prove Smith and Gunn guilty to exculpate himself, and I think that's the standard for prejudice in this vein.
I think likely better said he was just telling his story.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know, and I'm not saying he was being 100% truthful, but he was telling his story. But the legal test would be if his story is believed, would that mean the conviction of the other two was necessary? And that's just not the case, I don't think.
And that's the government's contention, Your Honor. And I think that's on all fours with the Allen case that we cited in our brief. In response to this claim of prejudice, again, and kind of getting back to the idea that Mr. Hixon's introduction of that Exhibit 17 that he introduced was a result of Mr. Martin no longer being present in the case, there's an element of sandbagging here that we didn't bring out in the briefs, but I'd like to just raise a bit. This was not a case, or at least this particular exhibit was not one where it was shown to defense right before it was put up. There was a recess, and if you go to, for later, if you look in Joint Appendix 2458, there were a number of exhibits that were considered. At 2476, the court and defense counsel talk specifically about Hixon 17, and the defendants, Smith and Gunn, do not object to it coming in. And this is an exhibit that had these two defense attorneys objected to it, it wouldn't have come in, Your Honor. This was a statement by an available declarant introduced for the truth of the matter asserted out of court for exculpatory purposes, at least what he thought. Had they objected, there's no way the government could have got it in at that point. The declarant is available. I mean, maybe at a different trial, it could come in as a statement against interest if Mr. Hixon was not present and was asserting a privilege against self-incrimination. But had these attorneys objected to it, it wouldn't have come in. So there's some irony in the fact that they're saying that their clients suffer prejudice from the fact that Attorney Martin is no longer in the case when Attorney Martin was not engaged to protect defendants Smith and Gunn. Their attorneys were there. They didn't object to it. And then later, they didn't ask for a limiting instruction. At no time did they ask for any type of instruction that would say, asking the court to instruct the jury that piece of evidence should only be used against Defendant Hixon. Even had they missed it initially, they had another chance to go at it in jury instructions, and there's no record that they ever did so. So now, after the fact, as they kind of deconstruct the case and what went wrong, they ascribe a lot of importance to Exhibit 17, which at the time apparently did not seem to them to be nearly as significant as they try to make it out to be now. Getting to Mr. Robinson's comments about...
Could Hixon have testified as to what was in 17?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But he could have done that even if Attorney Martin had remained in the case.
No, that, I'm right? saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I just wondered about the question about saying it's the other lawyer's fault for not keeping it out, maybe. It could have gotten in anyway, do you think? Or do you think, had they objected to his testimony, that would have been sustained?
I think the testimony comes in regardless, Your Honor. But certainly the exhibit was a hearsay document that could have been.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but it's not the fact. Is the fact there was a document in the record enough to be the error that caused them?
No, it wouldn't have been anyway. It wouldn't rise to the level of prejudice.
Question?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
A document versus his testimony. If you got the same information in front of the jury, would you have? Would the same information have gotten in front of the jury?
Your Honor, I'm just responding. In the brief, they ascribe a lot of importance to the document itself, the exhibit
that's
itself.
That's why I'm asking you about that.
Yes, sir.
Just for this arguments record, the fact that it's my understanding that Hixon could have testified to that same information.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that a document comes in with that information in it, you do have it in a document instead of spoken from the witness stand.
Right.
But it could be, and the jury, couldn't the judge have allowed that portion of the transcript of such testimony to go back to the jury? He could have said, could we, if Hicks had testified on that point.
Could they ask for a limiting instruction that only.
Nope. The jury could have asked, could we see the transcript of Hicks' testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So they'd have had a piece of paper, and the judge had allowed it, abuse of discretion. The judge didn't have that testimony on a piece of paper.
Yes, Your Honor.
It wouldn't have been a document formed at the time it was formed, but that seems like a fairly thin reed to hang reversible error on.
Yes, Your Honor. And again,
I know you're not arguing that it is. I'm just making responding to your argument you were making to the other side.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, Judge Shedd, you hit it exactly, the nail exactly on the head in pushing back on this idea that a short continuance would have done anything. And I think that clearly.
Well, I'm not so much saying that it wouldn't, but I'm just saying it looks like it's, you know, I'm not making that determination in the first instance, but it looked to me like that's what the judge was thinking about and easily could have thought about in this case. Just because you can find a very good lawyer, a very good lawyer is not going to want to step in the middle of that trial with 2-3 days notice.
No, I think that's exactly right. A very good lawyer would say, I'm not going to be effective unless I have plenty of time to prepare this case.
And rightfully so, maybe.
Yes, sir.
Docky, it looks like you're moving over to the issue of whether the judge erred in severing the attorney-client relationship. And I have a question about that because the defense argues that, in fact, there was on the record evidence of an irreconcilable conflict. And as I read the record, Mr. Martin, at one point, obviously he was sandbagged by, a little surprised by this disappointment of the client. But at one point, he stands up and he says, Your Honor, it seems to me, based on Mr. Hickson's statement, that he won't work with me and that there is, in fact, an irreconcilable conflict of sorts. What do you make of that, and is the judge bound to accept that?
Your Honor, I don't know what else Mr. Martin could have said in the while still representing his client. He's still engaged by his client, and I actually brought up my joint appendix just to that page, Your Honor, because the full colloquy there is, you know, he said, you know, I haven't seen the side of Michael Hickson. Yes, I'm somewhat angry. Most of all, I'm disappointed.
Why don't you just answer his question?
Yes, sir. But I think it's clear from the tone of Mr. Martin's response to the court's inquiry there that he is deferring to his client. He understands his client no longer wishes to be represented. He's not going to come back and say, oh, no, Your Honor, even though I'm being fired, I think we can, I think my client's wrong. I think he's sending that message subtly while still effectively trying to represent his client's interests. But I think that the court.
Well, I suppose if the judge had insisted that he do so, he would have. But the question is that concession enough by itself, or is the judge bound to accept that?
Your Honor, I don't think the judge is bound by the attorney representation in this instance without any kind of supporting facts that go to show the breakdown. And given that it was such on such short notice that you know, up to this point, at least in Attorney Martin's mind, you know, they had decent communication. They had been working together for 18 months before this point, actually even more than that. And then just, you know, over a 3-day weekend where there'd been no communication, his client comes back and says, you're fired. I can't work with you anymore. So I think in this circumstance, Mr. Martin was clearly taken aback, but still wanted to be deferential to his client.
Wait. Isn't it, if the lawyer stands up and represents, then the judge has to accept the fact that the lawyer has said that. But that doesn't necessarily mean it answers the. It is the legal determination that the judge has to make.
I don't think it binds the court. Right. That's. I agree with
you.
Well,
I don't know about binding the court. I don't know about binding the court anyway. But I'm talking about the judge has to accept the fact that representation was made.
Yes,
the judge could say, "Don't you think the judge could accept that?" You've said it, Mr. Lawyer. I've heard you say it. But I'm judging by how y'all operate together, what you've done to this point, that I don't think your statement. Whatever motivated it, I accept you said it, but that's not the end of it because the judge makes the final determination.
Yes, sir.
Based on not just those statements, isn't that what would have to be your position?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And then
the conflict.
Yes, sir.
And I think this was brought up during the opening argument. This was a complex accounting case. And apparently Mr. Hickson had some concerns about Mr. Martin's competence to handle that kind of a case. Well, the judge made some findings on the record that thus far Mr. Martin had done an admirable job handling the case. He also had a forensic accountant assisting him with the technicalities of the case. So it seems to me that with respect to the conflict anyway, the issue of the competence of the attorney is a relevant fact, and the judge made findings as to that.
Yes, sir. I think it's subsumed into some of the Smith factors, specifically about the relationship and the communication between the attorney and client that's relevant to the Smith consideration of whether or not there's a sufficient inquiry and then going to whether the judge abuses discretion.
We'd have to be leery of looking at the law too strongly set the other way, because I will make a prediction that the word got out that if a defendant stood up and said he had an irreconcilable difference with his lawyer, and a lawyer, maybe out of a sense of professional responsibility, didn't think he could go too far to challenge what his client said to the court, I'll guarantee you we'll have an increase in the number of claims of irreconcilable differences with lawyers in the middle of criminal cases.
And we pointed this out in our briefs, but the conduct between the two after that certainly belied. And really immediately after that, Mr. Hickson still asked that Mr. Martin be retained as a standby counsel.
Placing any blame. Let me tell you, a defendant who's on trial, who maybe doesn't understand, as the other side has pointed out, all the rules, he knows his freedom is at risk, and maybe he thinks he hadn't done anything wrong. Of course, he hadn't in the eyes of the law. And he wants the lawyer to be doing just what he wants. He wants the lawyer to be there when he needs him and to show signs every day he's working hard for him. It's understandable how a client might not be happy. You know, bar associations hear that all the time when people aren't happy with their lawyers. But that's why you have a district judge sitting there making findings, looking at the case, and seeing that the guy can act as standby counsel later. That ratifies it. It doesn't make the determination, but it ratifies it. But that's why the court's allowed to look at all that, don't you think? Don't you think all of that factors into?
Absolutely right.
And that's why we have an abuse of discretion standard, because a lot of things don't translate into the transcript, do they? You see, you watch, you look, and all of that in a record.
Yes, sir. Well, those were the only points I wanted to make in rebuttal. Questions?
What about the willful blindness issue?
Yes, sir. One thing that's important here, the government never actually introduced any direct evidence that any of the three defendants on trial said at any point affirmatively that they were participating in fraud. All of the evidence that the government introduced was really kind of something of dual use evidence, or evidence that could either show that
Is there proof to support a willful blindness conviction, and what is it?
You mean citing to specific?
Right.
I mean, there was a volume of evidence, Your Honor. I mean, the convenient ones to point to are the Lipsman email, the June or July of 2007 tactical solutions presentation, then Exhibit 17, which became available mid-trial. But there were other exhibits that were introduced and witness testimony that all three defendants, during the course of the Metro Dream Homes program, were aware that there was not sufficient revenue to satisfy the obligations they were continuing to take on. And that type of evidence supported either an inference that they actually knew that they were participating in a fraud scheme, although there was no smoking gun to that, or that they were deliberately ignoring those facts and chose to plow on recklessly. I see that the court fully understands our arguments, so I'll cede my time.
You don't waive anything else that you've made in your brief. Thank
yes,
you
sir.
Very much. Mr. Sicelli, I think you're next.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'd like to first respond to something the government brought to the court's attention. The government's position is that at bottom, the defendants all took the same tack, essentially that they acted in good faith. In a case like this, Your Honors, at bottom, the defendants are going to say they didn't do it. And in candor, this is not a case where they could get up and say this was indeed, in retrospect, this was a legitimate business. So the defendants all had to take that good faith tack. The question is, in the getting there, at the core of the defense, it's I acted in good faith because dot, dot, dot. And it's that dot, dot, dot that's the mutually irreconcilable part of the case here. Mr. Hickson's dot, dot, dot was, I was screaming that the world is on fire and no one was listening.
I screamed it at Mr. Smith, too, and Ms. Gunn helped me get the information that let me make that argument. And Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn's, I didn't do it, dot, dot, dot. Well, their dot, dot, dot was, we were coming to work every day doing what we thought was the right thing in a business that we knew had some financial difficulties, but that we were trying to right the ship to do the right thing. And the people in charge told us that the person ultimately in charge told us everything was fine. And it's that dot, dot, dot that is the irreconcilable part. To say that their defenses were mutually irreconcilable simply because they all said we acted in good faith ignores the how do you get there? What facts did each defendant point to show good faith? And Mr. Hickson pointed to facts which ultimately tended to inculpate Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn. But
tendency to inculpate isn't the standard.
It
isn't the standard.
Well, and I think that was inartful phrazing by myself. If you that was my error. The facts that Mr. Hickson pointed to are, if you believe that I told them on this date what I told them, then you couldn't believe what Mr. Smith and Ms. Gunn were saying. And it was, if you believe Mr. Hickson, you are convicting Ms. Gunn and Mr. Smith. And that's the core of the defenses in this case, and that's why they're mutually irreconcilable. Court's brief indulgence. Okay. And as to the willful blindness, if I could address that briefly. The government had mentioned Smith 7, and earlier the court had talked about Smith 7, and there was other things outside the context of Smith 7. The bank statements in this case all were sent to Mr. Williams. Information was deliberately withheld from defendants, in fact, that they didn't know, and they weren't even in a position to know. If you look at the testimony as it emerged, what the defendants in this case did, they were not even in a position to find out. So you could not deliberate ignorance is you're in a position to know something and you take steps, or the jury may infer you take steps to avoid learning a fact. If you are put in a position where you may not learn a fact because a fact is hidden from you, that is not deliberate ignorance, that's a lack of actual knowledge. So these facts which the government points to, which actually might suggest deliberate ignorance, lean more strongly towards addressing the dispute of whether or not there is knowledge or there is not knowledge, not whether the defendants took any steps to avoid learning certain facts which would show knowledge. If the court has no further questions, I will
thank you very much.
Sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins?
Very briefly. Thank you, Your Honors, again. Attorney Martin did, Judge Diaz, you were right, Attorney Martin did say that there was an irreconcilable conflict between the two. But it wasn't just his statement, and it wasn't just Michael Hickson's statement agreeing that there was a conflict. It was also, that was followed by a lunchtime altercation between the two out of court that was talked about in the courtroom when they came back. Apparently a very heated exchange where afterwards Michael Hickson once again pleads with the court, pleads, my life is on the line, I can't trust this man. He is, you know, and from his point of view, this was an irreconcilable conflict, and his counsel agreed, there was no dispute about it. Now, certainly he may have been a fantastic attorney, and he may have provided sufficient representation under Strickland, but this is a different standard. Thank you very much.
Mr. Robinson, you're court appointed, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
We acknowledge that, and thank you very much for your participation. We have to have that kind of participation. You've done a fine job for your client, we want to note. And Ms. Amato, present without arguing, we note you're court appointed too, and we thank you for your participation. We'll step down to Greek Council and go directly to the next case.